Morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State v. Brandon Dye. Mr. Porto, good morning to you. I should note that the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, Judge Moore, is sitting with the court on this case. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Porto, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Brandon Dye. And I'll just give I'll start with a brief recitation of the facts. Essentially, what happened in this case was Mr. Dye, and it's not really disputed, Mr. Dye broke into a hotel room in an attempt to confront somebody who he believed had wronged him in the past. And while he went into the room, he was greeted by relatives of that person. Mr. Dye then grabbed a cell phone from one of the people in the room and made a number of sexually suggestive comments, wouldn't let them leave, and then ultimately was apprehended later a couple blocks away from the hotel room. The defense at trial was from Mr. Dye was not that this didn't happen, but was based on the premise that it happened because he was essentially slipped a drug unbeknownst to him by a third party, Mr. Chad Willis. Now, with respect to this appeal, after the jury trial, but before the sentencing, an agreement was entered into between Mr. Dye and the state, in which the state agreed to dismiss the pending habitual criminal charge in exchange for Mr. Dye's agreement not to pursue an appeal or any post-conviction relief.
Mr. Porto, at that point, there had not yet been a hearing to enhance the offense as an habitual offense?
That's correct. There had been an offer made of the prior convictions, but that hearing did not come to fruition. It was essentially terminated in the middle by the judge. She requested that Mr. Dye's trial counsel meet with Mr. Dye to kind of go over the parameters of the habitual criminal offense, and it was during that interim period that an agreement was reached in which Mr. Dye agreed to waive his right to a trial, or I'm sorry, to an appeal and post-conviction relief. And then subsequently, Mr. Dye then filed a pro se appeal, which I think clearly was in violation of the agreement made at the time prior to sentencing.
Did the judge suggest to the parties that they should come to some kind of an agreement?
Yes, she did. That was suggested by the trial judge to the parties, and I think prompted the settlement discussions, which ultimately led to the agreement.
And is that a significant factor in this?
The judge's prompting of the parties to reach an agreement?
Yes.
Well, I think it did obviously put some pressure on trial counsel for Mr. Dye and for Mr. Dye himself, I think, to adhere to the judge's, obvious desires. And I think it probably did lead to the agreement. As far as whether that's a significant factor, I think there are other problems beyond that in terms of whether or not, in terms of the enforceability of this agreement.
What's the primary problem or problems that you see in terms of enforceability of the sentencing agreement?
Well, I think that the biggest problem, Justice Moeller-Lehrman, is that I think there's a public policy rationale that does not favor these sorts of agreements. And particularly, we have appellate review in order to protect the public's trust that what happens at the trial levels and what happens in our judicial system is appropriate. And when prosecutors, judges, defense counsel are all insulated from that appellate review by virtue of an agreement of this nature, I think it eliminates and removes an important avenue of disclosure to the public in terms of what is going on at the trial level, and it has the potential to erode the public trust in the entire judicial process.
Mr. Porto, do you concede that the great bulk of authority runs the opposite direction.
I do concede that, Your Honor. There's no question about that. The other major problem I have is that I think there is a clear public policy rationale that favors the development of case law. And that only happens through the process of appellate review. One wonders where we would be in terms of our criminal justice jurisprudence if we didn't have cases such as Miranda that only got to where they were because of appellate review. And where would they have been if the prosecutor decided that rather than have this landmark decision out that favors criminal defendants going forward, if it would be preferable to just simply make some sort of an agreement in terms of sentencing that would benefit that individual defendant at the expense of the development of important case law.
So is there a landmark decision hiding in this case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, there is a, when you get to the merits of the case and the underlying aspects of the appeal, I do think that the trial judge made an error in terms of what was considered with respect to the statements that were offered by Mr. Dye in the offer of proof.
Before we go there, however, back to your initial arguments, what is the remedy? Would we send this back for resentencing?
No, I believe that this court, the remedy would be simply to evaluate the appeal on its merits.
Well, let's assume it's an egregious conduct by the prosecutor and a Brady violation, which is unknown and then becomes known later. Would that type of an agreement foreclose a defendant from bringing a post-conviction or some type of action?
That's another major concern that I have.
Mr. Porto, we have here an agreement which purports to waive both an appeal and post-conviction. Obviously, the appeal portion is ripe for us to consider, but is the post-conviction a matter that's ripe for us to address?
Probably not directly at this point in time. But I do think the fact that the post-conviction waiver was part of that agreement is something that this court should consider when it evaluates not only whether these sorts of agreements should be enforced in and of themselves, but should this particular agreement be enforced. And what I'm getting at is, for instance, does the term post-conviction really simply mean actions brought under the Nebraska Post-Conviction Act, or does it also include, for instance, post-conviction actions under 29-2101, which would include things such as, the discovery of newly obtained evidence or DNA evidence, which may not be applicable in this case, but in another case, could mean that somebody who could show definitive proof of actual innocence could not pursue that case could not pursue relief because of an agreement made after conviction but prior to sentence.
Is this binary? In other words, are these agreements just all in or all out, or can an appellate court say these agreements, and we're calling it a sentencing agreement, this isn't a plea agreement,
right,
this is after trial, a sentencing agreement could be enforceable if, for example, the scope of what it included is this thing, like an appeal, or it was entered into knowingly and voluntarily, or so forth.
Sure, and that's obviously what this court will have to come to resolve at some level. Our position, Your Honor, is that these agreements should not be, no part of these agreements should be enforceable because of those policy rationales that were mentioned previously.
If it's not enforceable, is it possible to bring the habitual criminal back into play?
Yes. And that would be something that Mr. Dye would have to address at that point in time. I don't have much time, but I do want to address the merits of the case because I do think that that's important as well. And frankly, the essence of this is that the statement against penal interest, which was the purported hearsay exception offered by Mr. Dye does require that corroborating circumstances show that the veracity of the statement itself. But what was noteworthy in this case is that the state simply argued that it didn't believe this, that these statements were uttered in the first place. The judge did not give any rationale as to why she did not believe the statements were supported by corroborating evidence. But I think one can infer, based on the state's argument and the judge's brief order on that regard, that the court was also in agreement. And if you look at the Oregon case, it just lays it out perfectly. May I finish my brief thought here?
You may.
When the court considers whether corroborating circumstances are present, it should consider only the statement itself and the foundational aspects of the statement. Whether it was made by the declarant in the first place are issues for the jury to decide, not for the trial court in its gatekeeping function. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Your Honors, as an initial matter, I disagree that the district court did not find Dye to be an habitual criminal. As I read the record, the state offered four separate exhibits of prior felony convictions, all of which were received without objection, and the district court then found the defendant to be an habitual criminal based on two of those, which were burglaries, two separate burglaries out of Madison County. And it was only after he was found to be an habitual that the, if you'll pardon the phrase, judicial arm twisting began for them to reach some sort of agreement to essentially dispose of the habitual criminal allegations. And I think after the recess was taken, basically sentencing was recessed for a week, everybody went off and there were some apparently discussions made. And a sentencing agreement was reached by which the habitual criminal charge would go away in return for Dye's agreement not to appeal or file post-conviction proceedings.
Was the information amended to delete the habitual criminal allegation?
Not to the best of my knowledge. They just simply, quote-unquote, dismissed the habitual criminal.
Okay.
The court undertook great lengths to discuss the waiver with the defendant and actually placed him under oath to ensure that he understood what he was doing, that he understood the ramifications of what he was doing, and he assured the court over and over that he did understand it. And then after the district court sentenced him to a term of incarceration, which was apparently not to Mr. Dye's liking, then and only then did he decide that he didn't really like this agreement and violated the terms of the plea agreement by filing his appeal. I think that's clearly, there's no dispute that that's a breach of the plea agreement. I guess the only question now is what the remedy for it is. Every single federal district and federal circuit court finds that an agreement to waive appellate rights is enforceable because it's simply a right, and if you have the right, you have the right to waive that right. It's no different than the right to counsel, which we see waived all the time when somebody makes a statement to the police while they're in custody. It's no different than waiving the right to a jury trial. If you have the right, you have the ability to waive that right so long as it is knowingly, voluntarily.
Those line of cases deal with the waiver of post-conviction or habeas corpus in the federal system?
There are some cases that deal with that. It's apparently a less common practice or a less common procedure, but there are a few cases which we had cited to in our brief, one from Colorado, which says, absent an express provision of the contrary, the right to appeal doesn't foreclose a motion for post-conviction relief, but sort of by process of elimination, it says that you can waive the right to post-conviction relief. And several of the federal circuit courts have agreed that if the waiver of post-conviction proceedings is freely and voluntarily entered into, then there is no reason to invalidate that waiver.
Well, what if the defendant waives but it doesn't have within its knowledge certain evidence because it was not provided and a Brady violation?
Well, I suppose...
Don't you think that waiver of those rights would suppose that the defendant was completely informed of the facts and knew all the facts, and that if there were facts that weren't there and the defendant wasn't informed of them, that that would have an effect on the plea agreement?
I suppose that's going to be somewhat of a factual determination. If it's the materiality, I suppose, maybe, of the facts. If he has... If it's an honest-to-God plea agreement wherein he's entering a plea and the state and has agreed not to file an appeal, I would think then that because a free and voluntary plea waives all defenses, constitutional, statutory, etc., then I would think that that would have some impact on the analysis and probably...
What about focusing on the sentencing agreements, which is what we have here? Because now what we have is a defendant who's gone to trial and has a verdict.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
Kind of knows how this thing would shake out if it were tried.
Do you agree that it's purely a sentencing agreement, given that the habitual criminal enhancement was still on the table?
That's kind of a hard question to answer because of the way this all shook out. The fact remains that he had been found to be an habitual criminal. That was quote-unquote dismissed, whatever that means. So I suppose, I guess the way the district court and everyone at the district court level treated it was as if the habitual had simply evaporated. They treated the habitual as no longer a going concern. That being the case, the way it was treated was if it were strictly a sentencing issue. And I think there were ways to have done this that would have made a whole lot cleaner record, but we have what we have. And the habitual simply was basically removed from the equation, the way it was treated at the district court level.
You think the aspect of the agreement waiving post-conviction relief is ripe for us to even address at this point in time?
I don't know why it wouldn't be, because... the waiver of the right to pursue basically post-conviction, and I don't mean that in the post-conviction sense, but after the conviction relief, as long as that is freely and voluntarily done, it seems to me that that would be a valid waiver regardless at what point. It's either free and voluntary or it's not, and I think that is something we need to address right now at the time that the waiver is made. I don't know that it needs to be put down the line any further because it either is or it is not a free and voluntary waiver of the right to seek post-conviction relief.
Let me back up on the status of the habitual allegation. The state's position is that is... been, help me finish the sentence.
I'm not sure what it is. It's sort of out there, but not really being looked at. I mean, court clearly made a finding that he wasn't habitual, and then a week later they all came in and pretended that it didn't exist. I don't know how you dismiss something that's already been found.
But as Justice Castle was saying, the information and so forth wasn't amended during the course of this dealing.
Correct. The okay. Information was not amended.
But the sentence that was imposed was done as though there was no habitual...
That's correct.
...finding.
Right.
As though there were no findings.
Correct.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what we do with that, to be perfectly honest.
As though it were dismissed.
Correct. Okay. Right. It was, they proceeded with sentencing as if the habitual had been affirmatively removed from consideration just by dismissing it.
Well, if it was still in the process, then it wouldn't have been a legal sentence, right?
That's, yes. So I'm not sure what we make of what they did at the district.
It would not be an authorized sentence if habitual was still
correct,
in the structure
correct.
Of
the sentence that it,
okay.
Right. If habitual is actually still on the books, right. So to speak, then the sentence that was imposed is
that's
invalid.
Not authorized as
correct.
Done. Okay.
Correct. I have to agree with that. I think
but
in,
if we were to find that the agreement is not enforceable and we remanded for resentencing, there would be no double jeopardy issue with respect to enhancement, correct?
Correct. Correct. I don't think that would be a problem at all. Your Honors, I see I'm almost out of time. Unless there are additional questions, we would ask that the appeal in this case be dismissed pursuant to the line of cases from particularly the Eighth Circuit but the rest of the federal circuit courts, which hold that a valid plea agreement not to appeal results in essentially a cursory form of review, which we've set out in our brief, and if none of those conditions have been violated, then the appeal be dismissed, and we would ask that that be done in this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is Dye versus Kinney. And Mr. Dye, I believe, is pro se in this particular case. Is there anybody here for Mr. Dye, pro se in Dye versus Kinney? Then we will go on to...